You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is Bill Edwards. Welcome, sir.
Thank you for inviting me. And it's nice being available this morning.
I refer to you affectionately as my white whale. I've been wanting to have this conversation with you for over a year now, and you got a few things going on, so it's hard to get a hold of you, and I feel good about it finally happening, so thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. All right, so what's on your mind, Joe?
Well, what's on my mind is what's in your mind. You do so much in St. Pete and for St. Pete. You've built and owned and transformed so many different pieces of downtown. You have a lot of different businesses outside of the community building things, but I'm really curious as to what drove you. You know, a lot of times community building things can be less profitable than, you know, widget factories or the music business or whatever. What drove you to want to be so active and big in all the things you've done to transform St. Pete?
Well, I think I probably have to digress a bit. Okay. Back in somewhere around 1993 or 4, I brought a division of a small company out of Cincinnati, Ohio, to St. Petersburg. And I came to St. Petersburg to visit one of the lenders I was using to do mortgages. And what we did was we did nothing but veteran mortgages. We decided to focus on something that no one else wanted, because veteran homes in those days were, and still are, you know, smaller homes. And, you know, the average loan when I started this thing was about $50,000 to $75,000. A veteran, you know, at home. And so the lenders, the people who are out there doing mortgages and doing all these things, they told me when I used to go to the Mortgage Bankers Association meetings and stuff that I was dealing with blue collar, you know, workers and $50,000 to $75,000 homes, and one $300,000 home is a 4 or 5 of my loans. And, you know, I'd never make any money at it and so forth. And I come back and I go, guys, we're going to make a fortune. And you know what I'm going to make? A lot of money, is, and we're going to be successful, is because I've always made money by doing things other people aren't willing to do. Okay, so we decided we'd just focus on, and the only thing we did for almost 25 years was veteran loans. And in our first year, we did about $55 million worth of veteran loans. I can still remember the first party. We brought our own food, our Christmas party, and I had a DJ could afford in those days. And he said he had 800 songs, and he brought about 2 or 3 CDs. And I went, well, what's the 800 songs? He said, well, you didn't pay for the 800 songs. I have now. So I remember those days. And in 4 years of working hard, a lot of people working hard, we took the company from $55 million to, in 1998, that was 1994, 1998, we did $3.6 billion.
Wow.
Nothing but veteran loans. And again, we were under the radar. Nobody paid attention to us. And all the good guys at Wells Fargo's and Bank of America's and all those guys were doing every other loan but veteran loans. And so, you know, and we were refinancing veteran loans. And so with that in mind, we grew. And as we grew, we went from state to state. And over the 20 plus years that we were involved, we did about $57 billion worth of business in veteran loans. Just nothing but veteran loans.
Amazing.
And the reason we succeeded is because, first of all, I opened my office here on Central Avenue, where I'm still sitting, by the way. Okay, not in the same building, but across the street. Okay, and we opened it up here because this is the bus route. And in those days, we made a lot of phone calls. That's how we reached out to our customers. And so we had a lot of people working here and a lot of loan officers, and they traveled. We went to the veterans' home, and we sat at their kitchen table, and we petted their doggy, and, you know, and so forth. And, you know, I'm a veteran myself, so it bothered me that they called the veterans the blue-collar workers, the low-class people, low-class citizens, you know, and so forth when I was getting into this. So we decided we'd hire people, you know. And how I hired people was we talked to them on the telephone, and if they could speak good English and they could, you know, so forth. So we brought people in that basically, I think we probably employed over 20,000 people in St. Petersburg over the years.
Wow.
Okay, so anybody that reached out and knew the company Mortgage Investors Corporation in this city, you know, I know that there's a person on the city council that once worked in my company, and now they're on the city council. So we reached out to a lot of different people. And what happened was, by reaching out to the people in the community, we hired people that considered themselves pretty much unemployable because they didn't have a car, they didn't have the education they needed, but we trained them and we took the time with them and we built them into successful people, okay? Many of which are still, you know, working and doing well today. You know, there's people in our company today that have been here 24, 25 years. That's how long that's gone on. So what we did was we built a company that in its heyday had about 3,000 employees nationwide. We had 45 offices in 45 states, and we did this all over the country. And, you know, what happened was in 2006, I decided that the subprime loan market was scary and I couldn't compete with veteran loans. So I stopped doing it. And I had to lay the people off. And in August of 2007, 350 or more big companies, banks, GMAC, Bank of America, everybody countrywide, they all collapsed. Okay, and they had collapsed, and there was a website called mortgageimplode.com, and every day you check to see who was going out of business. You know, and I watched that for a while. And in August 2007, I decided, you know what? There's nobody loaning money to anybody. I think I'll go back and do my veteran loans again. And we were probably the only lender in the United States that was lending money for homes in 2007. And you can, if you recall back to 2007, it was horrible. Everybody was closed. Everybody was collapsed. The economy was destroyed. And we were thriving. Okay. Going into 2008, it really cranked up. And, you know, until 2013, we just went to work and we, you know, provided a ton of mortgages. We had a year we did $7.5 billion. But mostly every year we were doing $2, $3, $4 billion worth of mortgages out of this little place down in the corner on Central Avenue. Again, the people here had a job for 20, 25 years. We paid them above average pay. When I first started, we'd have 5, 6 buses pull up and the people would get out of the buses and they'd go to work. You know, and if you came to work on time for 2 weeks in a row, we'd increase your pay by $2 an hour and we'd also give you a bus pass. And pretty soon, somewhere along the line, I realized that I had this wicked, wicked parking issue. And I said, how the hell do I have a parking issue? And what happened was the people were coming to work on the bus. I noticed one day there was only one bus. It wasn't 5 anymore. It wasn't 6, you know. And they had made enough money where they were able to buy their own cars. And now I had this big parking problem. And across the street from me was a Christian Science reading room or something. And they were usually big parking lot empty, and I rented 300 spaces over there. And we had so many people here, we had to find ways to get out on this, you know, mirrors so people didn't get in accidents. And we had security that directed traffic, and we had space in between the shifts so the people who left had time to get out of the spaces so other people who came could get in the spaces. And it turned into a company that, you know, lasted for about over 20 years. And in that course of time, we provided veterans with $57 billion worth of housing. So that's how it all started. And during that period of time, those same people who were all over the city, I heard every story. You know, we worked in Midtown. We tried to help get, you know, they got a grocery store and then they lost a grocery store. We were involved in trying to get the new grocery store and we did. And we put money into that. And we realized that the people in the city who made us all this money were the people that we wanted to help. And that's how this all began.
Interesting. So what changed between iteration one and iteration two of the company with regard to the, you know, the credit profiles or how you were doing business? You know, you stopped the first time and then came back in 2007. How was the company different the second time than the first?
We were the only ones lending money, so there's no competition whatsoever.
All right. That makes life good.
Well, it does to a point, but then it makes you a target because we became the number one veteran lender in the United States.
Right.
Okay. And so everybody keeps records. And so these, you know, the rest of the Bank Americas and the Wells Fargos and everybody who didn't do these loans all of a sudden looked and said, how can they be the number one Ginnie Mae issuer? because, again, nobody wanted to buy the loans. So what I did was I carried the loans. I serviced the loans. And, you know, we had billions and billions of dollars worth of loans that we turned into securities with Ginnie Mae. And we were servicing them. And they were up. And by the way, our foreclosure rate was less than 1%. The one thing I knew about veterans was they'd rather pay their house bill and starve than miss a payment. Okay. I'm a veteran myself, former Marine from Vietnam. So I understand. And I figured, well, you know, if they think we're second class citizens, we ought to take care of them. And so I did. And then what happened was after 2007, all the banks got into it. Once they realized that, you know, who's this little company in St. Petersburg that's number one and doing veteran loans, they decided, well, we probably ought to figure out what they're doing and do it ourselves. So all of a sudden, you know, we went from having no competition, having nothing but competition.
Right.
When they finally started lending again, the majority of every major lender in the United States went for these veteran loans.
And here, by doing what others wouldn't, you showed them how to be successful. And you said earlier that you were successful because you'll do the work that others won't do. And I think that also has to be in part with seeing the things that other people can't see. Can you kind of dig into that a little more? Why do you think that you can see the things that others won't see and that leads you to do the work that others won't do?
There's a lot of people that are unwilling to do certain things. Okay. And in my opinion, to be successful, you have to be able to be willing to do anything it takes to be successful. Anything. Okay. So if they say, hey, listen, you know, part of your success is, you know, you got a list of things you're supposed to do to be successful. And it says, you got to go to Nome, Alaska for 2 years on that list and work on the northern slope with the polar bears. And you say, stop, time out. There's no way I'm ever going to go and do that. I'm not willing to do it. And you're going to fail because you're not willing to do something that's going to take to make you successful. Now, in the same instance, that list that they put together, chances are none of those things are going to come to pass. You never have to go to Nome, Alaska. But if you're not willing to do whatever it takes to be successful, then you're not going to be successful. And that's my creed, and that's how I feel about it. And that's what I taught my people and the people that worked here. And they were willing to go out and work and drive and work hard every day. And because of that, they were successful. And we spawned in this company, the company we had, probably over the 20 plus years that we were there, I think we spawned probably 350 millionaires that worked here, who made over $1 million.
When you reflect on your success and things you've just said, it's half the financial success that you've had and half the people you've been able to lift up. And ultimately that ended up playing a big role in the work you did later in St. Pete. So when you think about your drive to work tirelessly, and you still do, even now you're working huge days, how much of that drive is the money, or how does the money play a role in that drive, and how much of it is justice, you know, for lifting people up that are getting, you know, raw deal, and how much of it is community? Can you sort of break down what drives you?
Well, what drives me is the fact that I've been working since I was 7 years old, so I need the mental capacity to do things. I can't just sit around and not have the stimulation of having a problem and finding a solution for it, or trying to find a solution for it. The other thing is, I love employing people. Okay, I love having, you know, there's so many people that need employment, and there's a lot of people that people won't hire for whatever reasons. Okay, and we've had people that are disabled. We've had people that, you know, again, you know, the people that we hired that came to work, they didn't have enough money to buy a car. And, you know, I've got tons of stories of success stories of people who are now very, very, very successful in business and other businesses and, you know, have been here and they get their start here. They got their start, they got their ambition, they got their drive, they got everything from the things that we believed in. Again, you know, I'm a former Marine, so I'm OCD, so everything's got to be perfect. So I'm very detailed. And again, you know, for every action, there's a reaction. And so as long as you know that, it's amazing how people discount people because of the way they look or where they come from or where they live or whatever, okay? And me, I totally just do not discount people. And, you know, and I have this affliction for feeling responsibility that if I can help some people, I can find something that's good for the community. I made my money here. Why wouldn't I share it here?
How has that drive evolved over time? How has it evolved, or what new wisdom do you have now that you didn't have, say, 20, 30 years ago?
Oh, God, I don't know. There's going to be a ton of it. You know, you learn every day. I learned yesterday. I learned today. I learn every single day. And that's the whole thing. Get up an open mind and realize, wow, you know, I'm at an age now where you think, well, gee, you wouldn't learn. You're going to learn something every day if you get up and you do something. But if you don't do anything, you're not going to learn nothing. Okay. So I'd rather be up and doing things and get things accomplished. You know, I'd rather do something wrong than do nothing at all. And by the way, you have the right to do something wrong sometimes and make mistakes and still be successful. You can't be right all the time. You never can.
Can only aspire to. So we talked about then the seeds of where you dug into the community. You saw the folks were able to buy their cars. You bought the parking lot. You realized that the money you were making and the people that help you build that successful company were here. And that sort of set you down the road of bettering the community and, you know, making that cycle of prosperity even bigger. So then what were some of the early things that you were able to do or saw or tried to do then, you know, in the community building realm?
We built the All Children's Hospital. You know, we're very involved in that. We're involved in getting it going, getting up and running and getting the things that you needed and so forth. You know, it wasn't an easy task. And then, of course, we're involved in getting John Hopkins Medicine in there, which was very important to get John Hopkins into St. Petersburg, could you imagine? And having one of the top hospitals in the country be involved in our children's hospital. I think that's an amazing thing. The big thing was we wanted that medicine, okay? And it took a while for that to happen because, you know, even though John Hopkins' name was on the hospital, it didn't mean that John Hopkins' doctors had come here. And so I was very involved, and a lot of people were, but I was as well, in trying to go into Baltimore and trying to get doctors to come here and tell them how beautiful the place was and so forth. And as many doctors that, you know, that live here today that I know, that children go to school, and my children, that, you know, are from, you know, Baltimore, from the John Hopkins. And so we've been able to get a lot of people from John Hopkins to come in and actually finally make that a hospital that's got John Hopkins medicine and, you know, cutting edge technology. Of course, then a laboratory is built across the way and so forth. So teaching. And so I think that's a big home run for the city. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I'm still probably the largest single donor of that hospital. And so what I did with the money that I made was I gave back to the community as best I could. And I tried to help build the community. That takes you to, for instance, the shopping center and the Rowdy's and the McNulty Station garage that I bought and all the different things that we did to try to expand the city. I was the first guy in 2011. I bought a shopping center in downtown. And, you know, I had been developing on the beach, you know, condo hotels and things like that. So we'd had a good experience in development and sales. And so I saw that shopping center and I said, well, isn't that terrible? You know, it was a shopping center that's been closed for 7 years. It was ahead of its time and it didn't work. It didn't work for a lot of reasons, but it didn't work. It started to work and, you know, initially, and then it fell apart. So I decided, well, maybe it was timing. I know the people that did that, you know, the Assemblers, and they did a great job, and the Bullards and so forth. And they did a nice job of putting that together, okay, and opening it up, and they took a big chance. And it just didn't work for a lot of reasons, okay? But the bottom line to it was I decided that after a long period of time, it had been closed down for about 7 years. There was probably about four tenants in it. And so I bought it, and I decided, let's remodel it. Now, there was a choice there, okay? And the wiser choice would have been to just do a high-rise and go up and the first high rise in town and put some nice condominiums in there and sell them and make a bunch of money and walk away. And, you know, certainly if I had been smart, I would have done that. Okay. But I thought more of, you know, if I keep it low, because I think there's going to be high rises. There were high rises on Beach Drive at the time. And of course, they had the Ovation. It just opened not too long before that, I think. And so, I mean, I looked and decided, well, I'm going to make this like an oasis for the people in the high rises that could be able to come downstairs out of their places and go and make this the town square. Okay. And so we developed a shopping center that actually did that. I mean, when we do our Christmas lightings for Christmas and we put on our Christmas lights and we have Santa and all that stuff, you know, we light the tree. I mean, there's 6,000-7,000 people on that block that come out to see the tree lighting and stuff and get pictures with Santa for free and all that stuff. And so it's brought the families and a lot of people together that maybe don't go downtown enough and so forth. And so I think it's helped the city's population expansion. Once we started that, other people started building. And then I went ahead and I bought the old Toronto Park Canada block because I said, if I'm going to open a shopping center, I need more people in this town to come to the shopping center to make it successful. And so I wanted to start growth. And so I bought the Tropicana block purely for the reason of trying to get someone. Initially, I was going to build on it. And then I decided, well, you know, I got way too much on my plate, but I'll buy it. And Coulter bought it. And now, you know, that block is the one block. And it's a very successful project. And it's still successful. And it's got a nice hotel. I insisted that, you know, as part of the sale, that we have some sort of hotel there. We have a beautiful hotel there, 150 rooms, I believe. And Coulter, you know, before I had closed on it, we were able to sell it to Coulter. They didn't know what they were going to do with it. We suggested some things. As it turned out, they did about what we suggested, and they did a beautiful job. And that expanded that block. And then, you know, somewhere in that period of time, the Rowdies were going out of business. And the Rays were leaving. And as a company, the Edwards Group, we felt we were downtown, and we felt, well, wow, if we don't have a professional team in this town, that's going to be a real bummer for the population, for everybody, you know, not to have a professional sports team. So when the Rays were talking about leaving, I ended up buying a soccer team. I had never been to a soccer game, and I remember the first game I ever went to, I owned the team. And I was asking the coach, okay, well, what do we do to win the game, and what's the rules?
And why do they have so many players on the bench?
Exactly. Why do they have 11 guys? How many replacements can you have? Three. What are you doing on 11? We don't know which three. We're like, okay. I get that. So over the course of 5 years, we took the Rowdy from an almost extension to a well-received team where people came out. We sold out that stadium on many occasions. We put money into the stadium. It wasn't easy getting started with that thing. I spent a ton of money on it. But it was a very valid and still a valid team, and is probably the oldest team in the United States still active, was the Tampa Bay Rowdies.
When you talk about these different elements of the city that you bought, and I say this is sort of my personal experience too, as I acquire brands or build brands or whatever, or I see opportunity, it's a weird mix where, you know, you had this sort of micro benefit of building what ended up becoming the one, or seeing a vision for having those types of people there to serve your other investment in, which is the, you know, the Sundial, but yet it also serves St. Pete. And case in point, you could have built your own high rise where the shopping center was, but you saw that a town square was better for St. Pete, if not better for your pocketbook in that specific instance. So it's this weird sort of mix between internal business strategy for growing your own businesses, but also external strategy for growing St. Pete, and knowing that, you know, the two will always benefit each other as well. Is that sort of a fair summation of your process when you look at strategic uses of properties and an overall vision for what you're doing in St. Pete?
For St. Petersburg especially, yeah, because, you know, when we went to St. Petersburg, the whole thing was to, you know, as the town started to grow, let's face it, in the last 8-10 years, look at the growth of St. Petersburg. I mean, you could bowl through the sidewalks at one point. Beach Drive was really having a tough time. You know, there was a tough situation in downtown, and all of a sudden we started building, and then other people saw that. You know, they said, well, Bill Edwards is doing it. Damn it, you know, I probably should, you know. So things started happening, and we were very excited. And again, we took the Rowdies. We started bringing that many people downtown. When they were done with the game, you know, let's face it, the Rowdies game was 90 minutes. Started at 7:30 at night on a Saturday night. So you had 6,000-7,000 people in your downtown. Then your bars thrive, your restaurants thrive, all the rest of the people thrive because they're done at 9 o'clock, 9:30, and it's a Saturday night. They're going out. They're already parked. They're good to go. And they go out and they bring income into the rest of the businesses, and they give a boost to the business, the downtown. That's what you need. You need something. And we did concerts, and we, you know, we did different things to bring people downtown during the week, because I knew during the week my business was very slow. So if I could bring 6,000-7,000 people downtown early and then have the rest of the night for them to go do something, they go to dinner, they go have drinks, they go to a museum, whatever was open, they'd go to. And so what we did was we created more people. By creating more people, you go around there now, across the street from Al Lang, there was nothing going on there to speak of. Now you've got high rises. Since I remember going to the stadium, and I ended up going, there's only one box. The rest of the boxes are used for television and sound and so forth. But there was one box, and I never used to go to the box, and I'd just, you know, be down and I'd be behind the bench and sitting in my seat. But the bottom line to it was the people started coming down there and realizing this is a beautiful place. And all of a sudden, I looked out of that box one day and I saw three or four buildings that weren't there when I started. And I went, where the hell did those buildings come from? I didn't even realize they were built. And they were all new condos and apartments. And people started building. And then I think that the rowdies had a lot to do with that section of town's growth because, you know, people were going there. And they said, well, people go there. And they started looking for places to go to eat and drink and so forth. I remember buying McNulty Station's five stories of McNulty Station, which is a parking garage right around the corner from the rowdies, so we'd have parking day on Saturday nights. Now, during the week, other people parked there, but on Saturday nights, it was rowdies night, you know. And you could park for $5, you could go in, and you walk half a block, and you were at the stadium. And, you know, I sold that since then, but still, on Saturday nights, the rowdies, it still got rowdy signs on it. I sold it with the understanding we keep the rowdy signs on it for a period of time. And, you know, everything I did, you know, when I exited thinking what implications would happen once I exited to the rest of the town. And so I took precautions on everything I did to make sure that it was a good final. And, you know, when I ended something, made sure it was good for the rest of the people.
All right. You mentioned that St. Pete has grown immensely, and it has, and your work and your brand has grown accordingly. And, you know, obviously being in the music business, you understand the importance of image and brand, and you have the Bill Edwards Group, the Bill Edwards Foundation. But at the same time, you know, I think there are aspects of being one of the wealthier folks in town where everybody always wants something from you. And you're putting yourself out there with the foundation and with your, you know, public good mindset that that's a reasonable thought that they would have. So how have you felt about your personal brand and trying to sculpt it and using it to benefit the things that you're doing? And then sort of off of that, you know, what are sort of some of the time-consuming pieces of being so well-known and so demanded?
First of all, I've never tried to do anything about my personal brand. My brand is my businesses and the things I get involved in. And, you know, I branded the Rowdies. We branded the Sundial. All those things were huge jobs to brand them. Okay. You know, I mean, we take a team that had no spectators, okay, to speak of, and turned it into something where you had sold out games over a period of time. That took a lot of branding, a lot of time, and a lot of energy, a lot of social media, a lot of talking, putting a good team together. Come on, we brought in Joe Cole out of England, out of Premier League. He used to play with Beckham. Okay. We brought in Marcel Schaefer. We brought in serious players to play in the soccer game, okay? And that made the Rowdies so much more valid as a team that people wanted to come because, you know, there was amazing soccer being played. And if you're into football, you're into soccer, you brought in some great players. And, you know, and I didn't know anything about it, but I didn't know who the stars were because I studied it, okay? And like anything else, I had great people around me. You know, there was people like Lee Cohen and just a ton of people, Beth Herendeen, and all these people that helped us, you know, build a brand and build a good team. Okay. And through that, I just try to get the best professionals. Not knowing the soccer business, I had to listen to several different people's opinions on it. And then I had to decide, did I agree with their opinion or not based on their performance? Okay. And I went through a lot of people over the course of time with Rowdies. But in the same instance, at the end of the day, I think I ended up with a great product. And, you know, obviously the Rays thought that too, and they bought it from me. And now they have it. And the Rays live on. And the Rowdies live on.
No doubt. That was an amazing transformation. And the Rowdies are one of the strongest brands in St. Pete. And I think the Rays saw that, as you said. But you still, when you do things, it makes news. And obviously there was the news around the mortgage thing, which congratulations, that finally you put behind you last fall. But when you're working with the city and you're, you know, working on these big contracts and doing the concert series and things like that, you know, you just can't escape it. Your presence is just too big to stay under the radar. So even though your intention is you know, you're not specific, you know, intentionally, personally trying to work on it, you're sort of a victim of it to some extent.
It's an occupational hazard.
Yeah. You just, you know, worked with Meals on Wheels and supported them in a big way. Can you talk about what you saw in that need and why you were drawn to support them?
We've had a foundation that's been around for about 19 years, I think we've done it. Okay. And every Christmas, we go to Midtown at the Jet Center And before that, we did it in a parking lot, but then we found the Jet Center as our home for this. And we take underprivileged families and we give them Christmas. We provide them with meals and toys and Santa, and celebrities come and they sign baseballs and footballs and soccer balls. And we have a little party for them. We have blow-ups and we do all this stuff. We do it every year. We do, you know, 200-300 families. We were doing that and they're all kids. They're mostly on the school lunch program. And that usually means that they may not get breakfast, they may not get dinner, but they're getting lunch. You know, I hate to say this, you know, all the wondrous building and we do downtown and everything, but there's a lot of people in this town that are underprivileged and they have poor housing and they have no housing and they have no food. They don't have a grocery store and they don't have a bank. And they don't have a, you know, a place to go and get health care and so forth. And for some reason, they're here. We're not talking about them. We're talking about, hey, that big high rise downtown and this here and that there. Through my years of being part of the community, I've grown to know where all these places are. And so I realized that, listen, if the kids can't get to school because you shut down the schools, how are they getting food? So I went to the mayor and I said, Mayor, how am I going to find all these kids? And he said, he put me in touch with some people in the city and that he thought may help. Okay. And I went through it and I found the folks from Meals on Wheels and they had put together a program for children. And I said, well, this is great. Okay. So what are you doing for the children? And they said, well, we're trying to do is give them at least 5 days worth of groceries that are non-perishables that they can have, like potatoes and carrots and things that don't, and bananas, things that don't go bad, you know, and it can be on the shelf and you can eat them and you can have them and then give them warm meals. And I saw that's how that was going. And they had a monstrous amount of need. They didn't have the resources to do it. So the money that we were going to spend for Christmas this year, we decided that we better do something now. So my family foundation took the money, you know, and which most of the money comes from us. We have people that donate, but the majority of the money, at the end of the year, we make up the difference. And when we do this thing for the kids, buying the toys and everything. So we took that money and we put it into Meals on Wheels. And then we found that their biggest problem was getting the groceries, one, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, and two, getting them to where they had to go. So then my foundation at the theater, the Foundation for the Arts, created a group of people who became the labor. And we used the lobby of the theater to pack the groceries, pack the boxes, and put them in buses, actually take them out and deliver them. And our goal is to put out 50,000 meals. And I think we're probably around 25,000 meals we've provided so far. And obviously, these people needed these meals. They wouldn't be taking them and eating them. So I think we're providing a service that's definitely needed in the city. Meals on Wheels, you know, they're a great organization. They're doing a great job with it. And I've been able to get volunteers from our foundations and the people that know our foundations to come in and help them, and using the money wisely and being able to get it to the people that need it as quick as possible.
It's wonderful. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for your service as well. I know you won a Purple Heart, and I wanted to mention that when you're...
Thank you. I call that the booby prize. I should have ducked more.
So we're getting close to the end of our time. I wanted to finish up. If you were, you know, 40-year-old Bill Edwards, looking at St. Pete as it sits today, you know, 40, 50 years of, you know, action ahead of you, mm-hmm. What do you think you would concentrate on? What do you see from where St. Pete sits today that Bill Edwards would drive things, you know, with that time horizon ahead of him?
I don't know. I think more affordable housing for people is definitely a need in the city. I think that, you know, dealing with, you know, things that people aren't dealing with in the city, the most important, you know, there's a lot of areas in the city that aren't as beautiful as downtown or as grandioso or even acceptable to live in. You have people living in them. And I think those are the people that are the future, and their children are the future. And if we don't take care of them and get them the education and get them the food and get them the housing and get them jobs, and make them, you know, active parts of the community, then you're going to have the anarchy that, you know, I'm seeing in this country right now. So, and that goes for a lot of towns, not just ours, but a lot of places where everybody has these pockets of towns where they need help and people just shy away from looking. They don't see it. It's not brought out. It's kind of shuffled under the rug, and it's time we realize that there's a lot of people that are very, very nice people. They're good people. You know, they just don't have the opportunity that they should have, and we should try to provide opportunity for them. And if I was younger, I'd be doing the same thing I was doing when I was running my mortgage company, giving those people that didn't have opportunity the chance to have an opportunity. And again, someone that worked, started, came on a bus and came here and worked for this place are now city council members and people that, you know, are successful business people and so on down the line from starting here and coming on the bus. Okay, so you need more people that are willing to take the people on the bus and teach them the things that, you know, everybody's high tech and all this thing. But the bottom line to it is if you took the time to take a look at the people that aren't being paid attention to, pay attention to them, you're going to find this, it's going to be a better world for everybody.
It's wonderful. We finish most of our programs with a shout out. Who's someone in the community that you've seen doing work that you'd like to give a little extra attention to for the work that they're doing to help St. Pete?
I think there's so many people in town. It'd be, you know, just so many people that do a lot of work, that the assemblers do a lot of work. Mark Mahaffey and his family have done a lot of work in this town. Tom James has done a lot of work in this town. The Huffs. I can go on and on with the people, the Wannicks. They, you know, they have been the driving force in getting things done, many of them, by their philanthropy. The Crown Motor Car Company, Dwayne Hawkins, and people like that. They're people of my age or less, you know, but they're people that they have families that have grown up into the business and are still following through with their dad's ideas on how to be a good business person and how to take people and mold them into something they weren't and make them useful and active and very successful people. And that's what you need to do. You don't find successful people. You create successful people by working with them and training them and teaching them, having the patience and giving them a decent job and paying them a decent wage to be able to live. And so those are some of the people. There's a lot of them, okay? But those are kind of the people that, you know, I look up to for doing that, especially the Huffs. They both passed away. You know, they were great people. When I came to town, they were the people I looked at and went, wow, I'd like to be like them. I'd like, you know, one day, you know, when I came to town, I didn't have a whole bunch of money. Believe me, it was something that we grew and we built. We didn't start with a lot of money. We started, I don't know if you know this, but we started a company on a $30,000 note, a 90-day note. And we built it into what we built it into from there by hard work and long, long hours and everything. And again, you know, doing the things that I talked about. So it's not like something where I was growing. I grew up in a family that was six kids. My father was a cab driver. My mother was a waitress. We had no money. We had no food. I started working when I was 7 years old. I didn't get a formal education. By 14, I was out of school and I was working as a commercial fisherman. Joined the Marines when I was 17, 18. And the rest is history. And all through my life, I worked all kinds of jobs, construction, to you name it. And one day God shined down on me and gave me enough intelligence to start a business that made me more successful. And by being more successful, I thank God for it. And I try to give back.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpetx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owners representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit ceag2.com. That's CEAG, the number 2.com. And thanks also again to OPEN, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Aresti speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.